JSF is an adventure like a ride in a hot air balloon. Exciting, unpredictable, and full of the unexpected. Your support makes it all possible. Help keep the adventure going and flying high with a donation right now to Fun Drive 2025 at cjsffundrive.ca or by texting the word donate to 778-782-2573 to get a donation link. It's all because of you that we can rise higher and reach further.
You can deny all the things I've seen, all the things I've discovered, but not for much longer. Because too many others know what's happening out there.
I want to believe.
Hi, this is David Duchovny, and you're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby.
New Dimensions Radio has been making a difference on our planet since 1973, thanks to the generosity of our listeners. You too can help make a difference with a tax-deductible donation or membership. Please visit our website, newdimensions.org, and just click the Donate button. We at New Dimensions thank you for your support. It is only through a change in human consciousness that the world will be transformed. The personal and the planetary are connected. As we expand our awareness of mind, body, psyche, and spirit, and bring that awareness actively into the world, so also will the world be changed. This is our quest as we explore new dimensions.
Our guest today, storyteller and mythologist Dr. Martin Shaw, shares this sage advice. You are only here for a short time. God has blessed you, so rise up. Find out what you love. Speak it. Be it. Steward it. Nothing else will quite fill your soul or make such deep purchase in your heart. It will make you kind. It's not the only way, but it has claimed me, and I will put my shoulder to its service while I am here. In a rush to solve all the problems of the world, there are those who are advising us of the need to be telling a new story. Shaw challenges us by suggesting the stories we need turned up right on time about 5,000 years ago. Today we'll climb the attic steps and kneel before the old trunk, gently lifting the lid and allowing these ancient tales to rush out and pierce our hearts and souls with their wisdom. Our guide in this quest is Martin Shaw. Dr. Martin Shaw is a storyteller and mythologist. He's a wilderness rites of passage guide and is internationally regarded as one of the most exciting proponents of mythic imagination. He tells prophetic stories that speak deeply to the challenges we face today in the world and in our personal lives. He has devised and led the oral tradition course at Stanford University and is a visiting fellow at Schumacher College and the director of West Country School of Myth, a learning community in Dartmoor in the far west of the United Kingdom. He's the author of many books, including A Branch from the Lightning Tree, Snowy Tower, Scatterings, and The Night Wages. Join us for the next hour as we take a deep dive into our mythic imagination with our guest, Dr. Martin Shaw. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. I'll be your host. Welcome to New Dimensions. Martin, welcome.
Thank you very much, Justine. I'm delighted to be here.
It's a delight to have you. Thank you for coming. And I'd like to begin, first of all, talking about myths, fairy tales, folk tales, you are immersed in them. And why are they significant to us right now in this time?
I would say they are the way our ancestors tried to tell the truth. And my introduction to that world came in the house that I grew up in. So I grew up in the early 70s in a house that seemingly lacked a lot of things. It didn't have a phone, it didn't have a television, didn't have a car. But we had a lot of books, and I had a mum and a dad, who I still have, who cherished language as a form of wealth. And story itself was one of the highest expressions of that wealth. And so I learned to think in images from the beginning. I think in images. And I remember as a kid, as a little boy, I realized that within the space of a day, it was quite hard for me to maintain the shape of a little boy all the time. Sometimes I would feel that I was about to become a bear or a salmon or a hawk. In other words, I was a little kind of shape leaper, shapeshifter. And even at that age, stories would talk about that part of the human psyche, that we were more porous than our little schools would have us believe. And it just made immediate, profound sense to me. When I heard a story, I would feel like I'd been fed, like some essential nutrition had moved into me. So stories, fairy tales, folk tales, legends, arriving from the oral tradition, I think they are more than human beings sitting in their neurosis, wondering about the world. I think there's the possibility that some of these stories actually have the earth speaking through them. So in other words, there's more than just human intelligence at play. And as I got older, that became really captivating to me. So if someone was to say, why do we need those stories now? We only have to look for a second at, you know, what's happening with our climate to realize it's one thing to talk about climate change. It's one thing to talk about the earth. But could it be that secreted in these ancient stories, the earth is talking back to us?
In that case, what stories? These are ancient stories, and we're talking about things that are coming to us seemingly from a long time ago. But you're saying that it has reference to where we are right now.
From the very basic idea that most stories begin with a hopeless cause. Goethe would say, you know, until there's some boldness in you, invisible forces in this universe will not rise to meet you. So actually, when I see this kind of moribund timeline predicted for us, I think, oh, it's perfect. It's time for the mythic imagination. Stories allow little pinpricks of the miraculous into them. And whilst I have a clear and sober sense of how late the hour is for us ecologically, I won't close the door to that miraculous possibility just yet, because even in my own few years on this planet, again and again and again, I've witnessed the impossible manifest. And I don't think, and I'm kind of echoing Wendell Berry here, I don't think that a big question can be solved by a big answer. I don't really believe it. I think myth deals in specificity. A lot of myth is very localized. So we're very keen these days on where did our bread come from? Where did our lamb come from? Where did our beer come from? Where did your story come from? Wouldn't it be an amazing thing, and I'm mentioning some of my great heroes today, to do what Gary Snyder always advised, which is be famous for 5 miles. Draw a little chalk circle around where you live and dig in. And that doesn't have to be a rural situation. That could, you know, Blake found a lot of what he needed in London. You know, Blake's walking along and you and I see a thistle. Blake sees a little glowing grey man waving at you. It's how I think myth right now could move us from seeing the ecological predicament into beholding the ecological predicament. Now, how do you behold a predicament? You stop telling it what it is. You stop telling 2019, you stop telling the times that we're in what they are, and you just bear witness to the unfolding. That doesn't mean passivity. It means manners, actually. It means behaving in a certain way. If myths have, to repeat, a more than human intelligence at play, and indigenous stories have a lot to offer in this regard, as well as the sort of the propelling heroic narrative of the West. There are many other rhythms to stories that we need to know about, and we could talk about that in a while, maybe. Campbell used to say about myth that we all gag on true doctrine. Old myths generally have something in them that do not fit the polemics of our times or our personal lives, and that is the bit we need to pay attention to. The problem with the idea that you can just create a myth out of the ether is it's very unlikely that it's going to have any ancestral roughage in it.
So that has to do with, oh, we need to create a new story, that conversation that's happening. Oh, we've got to create a new story or a better story.
Yes. I mean, on an immediate level, speaking as a feminist, I absolutely think we need a new story when it comes to how men and women have treated each other. So I get it. But when you're talking about something as profound, not just as a story, but a myth itself, which is to do with the passage of time and space. Tolkien didn't write a myth with Lord of the Rings. Jeanette Winterson doesn't write myth. J.K. Rowling doesn't write myth. What they do write is incredible, beautiful, sophisticated, mythic stories. The mythic and a myth are not quite the same thing. Myths, in the way I understand them, in certainly the oral tradition of storytelling understands it, they don't have a distinct author, because they could have come from a weather pattern. They could have come from a crow. They could have come from that secretive little bend in the river where the salmon used to gather. We would not be so naive to claim authorship of the story. We're just passing it on.
Well, that just reminds me, I sing in a gospel choir, and the songs we refer to mostly are those that are unauthored, unsigned, those that came over from and sung by dark people who came against their will, that worked under the sun for many hours. And those don't have an author. And those feel so authentic. They feel something deeply moving. The struggle and the need for freedom is all there. And that's what you're saying about these ancient myths. There's something there that's deeper.
Yes, they're not slick.
They're not Disney.
They don't encourage multitasking. They need real attention. They need focus. The word that I tend to use is they need fidelity. So if you really want myth in your life, you have to show up for the myth as well as the myth showing up for you, which might mean that you say, you know what, for this winter, all I'm going to do is really, really study. It could be the Iliad. It could be a Siberian folktale. But I'm going to turn up to this story so many times I make it blush. In the Irish tradition, if you go to the other world, if you go to the land of the Tuatha De Danann, the people of art and light, if you go to the fairy, there's a surprise waiting for you, and it's this. Their storytellers tell the fairy stories about us. We are the dream of the other world to them. When they gather by the fire, it's our stories they hear. So we need to live lives interesting enough to beguile the fairies.
I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Dr. Martin Shaw. He's the author of The Night Wages and many other books. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions. I'm here with Dr. Martin Shaw. He's a mythologist. He's a speaker of myths and gatherer of myths, and he communicates and helps us to unpack them, so to speak. He's also the author of The Night Wages and other things. If you want to know more about his work, I'm going to give you a couple of websites. First, his website, drmartinshaw.com, Dr., just the abbreviation, Dr., martinshaw.com. Or if you want to really access his books, the many books, Snowy Tower, The Branch from the Lightning Tree, and other books, you can go to, it's called SistaMystica.com, C-I-S-T-A-M-Y-S-T-I-C-A, SistaMystica.com. Or you can get to both of those through the New Dimensions website, newdimensions.org. So, Martin, you've started us off, and there's so much I want to talk about that you've given these clues as we go along. But one of the things that I'd like to talk about, and I know that you have given some thought to this, and it has to do with what I would call vertical intelligence and horizontal intelligence. Mm. And I think this has something to do with the way we understand myths or have a relationship with myths. So can you say something about those two kinds of intelligence?
Yeah, certainly. And these are old ideas. I'm just moving them on into the world a bit. You could say that a vertical intelligence is a moment where you as a simple human being are overtly reaching out to the divine world. When you are entirely engaged in the horizontal, which absolutely has its merit, it tends to be more practical concerns. Now, let's be clear. Of course, there's 100,000 ways those two worlds interact all the time. And a point that I would want to make is when I'm referring to attention to the divine world, I'm not necessarily referring to something the other side of Pluto. I'm not referring necessarily to what we might conceive of as heaven. It could be a little rowan tree at the bottom of your garden. It could be the little birds that gather, the swifts that gather at the bird feed. It could be a mountain. It can be secreted amongst us all the time. It's really what, to talk about him again, Blake would call pinpricks of the eternal. Often if you notice, and I'd say this to all the listeners actually, if you notice that you are regularly falling into depression during your day, the mythological Aikido move to make is to question, how often a day do I get pinpricks of eternity entering it? How am I so hooked up in the time bound I can't access the timeless? Stories are a crossroads between the timeless and the time bound. So they carry these essential eternal truths that we all recognize. But at the same time, you and I live in bodies, and over time, those bodies go their own perfect route. And
Sad to say, yes.
And it's also part of, you know, the delicious sorrows of the world that that happens. But if you are around stories regularly, if you're around storytelling, even if you read out loud, you will find tremendous nourishment in it. And it's as Captain Beefheart used to say, stories are a mood propellant. I love that. Mood propellant. And so you can shift from one place to the other. My old mentor, Robert Bly, would call this moving from the first castle to the second castle. So another way of thinking about vertical and horizontal is actually, and all the writers out there, I think, will relate to this. I call it, you know, day and night intelligence. When I'm writing a book like The Night Wages, a lot of the really succulent bits of it come from very late at night. I realized years ago that I write in an entirely different fashion after 11 p.m. than I do in the early morning. I even figured out that in the cottage that I write the books in, I have different forms of thought in different parts of the cottage. So I have several desks, and the books and even the sentences you read in my books are usually a braided knot of day and night intelligence. And if I want to crank up my ideas and my sense of the conceptual, I go to a particular part of the house. If I really want to invoke the editor in me, I will work early in the morning, drink good coffee, and another desk brings out the editor. So in other words, the house itself, Gaston Bachelard talks a lot about this, is an organic, soulful, living, interruptive presence. So in that sense, the horizontal, the mundane, and the vertical, the divine, or whatever word you want to call for it, are in this crossroads. And the god of the storytellers is called Hermes. And where do you go to worship Hermes? You go to the crossroads.
I love it. I love it. Which takes us a little bit to the premise of this most recent book, yes. The Night Wages.
Yeah.
Tell us a little bit about the premise of this book and the idea of it and what stimulated you to even sit down and write it.
Well, what stimulated me to write it was just a series of very ordinary catastrophes that most people in midlife experience. But all of us, you know, the gods will curate the particular derailment that we need, maybe. I don't want to say that all suffering is good. I don't want to kind of wink at the listener and imply that for a second. There are things out there that we're never going to get over. But as I hit my mid-40s, I went through a period of proper, profound sorrow, real sorrow. And now that's one thing to cope with. But if you are a parent, as I am, and you've got a child that you're raising in the middle of this unutterable loss, you really start to call on whatever your nutrition is to get you through this. How do you and the child stay in the story when the story seems to be disintegrating in your very hands? So the book began actually when I wrote a letter to my kid, my daughter. And in it, I just started to write about the things I utterly stood for. Something that she may be able to look at when she was older. This is what your dad loved. This is what he defended. This is what he cared about. This is what he lost. This is what he gained. And I started to realize that this might be a book that would be useful, or a thing, actually. I didn't think of it as a book at the time. This could be something that's useful for other folks as well. I would have loved it if one of my literary heroes at a certain point, and actually one of them did do it. C.S. Lewis wrote a book called A Grief Observed, and that was a very useful book for me when I was going through this period. So it's a love letter to the thing that I love most in the world, which is my daughter.
So, and I know that you say in the book, you give a phrase, I don't know if she actually said this, but she said, I just imagine you in your depression, your grief, whatever you're going through, and we all do this, that we get so walled off in our own deep sorrow. And yet there's this kid out here, and they're wondering, am I still in your story?
Yeah,
and she asks the question, am I still in your story? And then what I gathered from this particular book is that you get to a deep, deep sense of authenticity, that you can't lie about it. You can't just smooth it over and say, oh, I'm feeling fine. Oh, I buck up and you put on the smile. But you take us deep, deep into what it means to be human and yet still survive.
Yeah. Yes, thank you. That I think it was that. There's a phrase in the book that I come back to, and it's this: our heartbreak is not our kids' business. The kid is not your shrink. It is not your therapist. Don't do that. Cut that out. And so I realized quick, I didn't need to be Superman to my child, but I needed to be able to function in the world. I needed to be able to speak of it with a degree of elegance, a degree of truth, and as little malice as possible. And so that was what I did. I statements are one thing, you know, an I statement. But when you bring in a myth, the myth or the fairy tale or the folk tale takes the tributary of your experience to the great river that is the old mythic stories. And so these stories supported me through this period of time. And they did more than that. They deepened me. An image in one of it's a thing I talk about in the book called Becoming Crocodile, where there is an African village where at a certain point, I think this was amongst the men. I don't know if they did it to the women as well. It's kind of brutal. You would be taken out into the bush, and for a period of time, your back would be beaten with sticks so severely that the skin itself, when it healed, was ridged like a crocodile. When you would come back to the village, if people had really deep questions about the business of suffering, the business of living, the business of trying to become a human being, you would go to ask those questions to someone that everybody knew had become crocodile. So you see, we're back to the shape-shifting of me as a little kid. When I thought, oh, well, I'm of kind of a boy, but I'm also kind of a bear, and I'm also kind of a salmon, and I'm a little bit of a fox. As you get older, we do change shape. And the night wages is an acknowledgement, I suppose, to myself that I have changed shape. I am fundamentally a different man to who I was half a decade ago. I am profoundly changed. In Greek myth, think of the Odyssey. The old Greek word that describes the Odyssey is nostos. Nostos is the longing for home. Do you remember Odysseus is trying to get back to Ithaca, this rather nondescript island filled with goats and rocky crags. But it is his yearning to get home that propels him through the story and the winding route it takes from leaving Troy. And Nostos, I think, is culturally getting us into a lot of trouble at the moment. I think Nostos is behind Brexit. I think Nostos, in a rather warped way, is to do with some of the political things that are happening in America at the moment as well. We all remember, we all have an image of being in the garden. We have an image of being in the garden. And you can manipulate that in people. You can colonize people's imagination when you evoke Nostos.
Oh, we've got to go deeper with all of that in just one moment. Thank you so much. I want to remind our listeners that I'm here with Dr. Martin Shaw, and he's the author of The Night Wages. I'm Justine Willis-Toms. You're listening to New Dimensions.